Hello and welcome to another episode of the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. From time to time on this podcast, I like to approach conversations about investing from a bit of a different angle. And that's what I want to do for this episode. When you invest in a business, you're backing the management team to deliver on their word, and you're backing the team to follow through on the business strategy. So why do some businesses succeed and some fail? Of course, people's core competencies will be a big factor in their ability to do the job successfully. And there's other factors that impact a business too. And that's the culture of the business and how the team members can work together successfully. As the saying goes, a champion team will always beat a team of champions. So for this episode, I want to focus in on just that. I want to speak about the importance that teamwork and culture plays in determining business and also sporting success. And I've got an expert in the area who we're going to be talking to. Chatting today with Ray McLean, who is the founder of Leading Teams. Many listeners may be familiar with Ray and Leading Teams, as he's been very successful with some high-profile sporting teams over a few decades now. I was actually lucky enough to be part of Ray's system for quite a while. I first crossed paths with Ray around the end of 2005 when I first joined the Sydney Swans from my previous club, the Essendon Bombers. For Ray, it all began back in 1989 when he worked with the RAAF as a training and leadership officer and was responsible for the design and delivery of leadership and team training for the Airmen Aircrew Training Unit. In 1992, whilst doing this, he also ran a pilot program involving the Central Districts Football Club in the SANFL. And for those not familiar with that acronym, that's the South Australian National Football League. I'm not sure why there's the N, the National, in there, but that's another story for another time. Anyway, from there, he's gone out into working with many of the biggest sporting teams in Australia, and as well as a lot of corporates too. Okay, that's enough of a runway for the conversation. Let's get into it. As always, the usual disclosures. This episode is just for educational purposes only and does not qualify as financial advice. People may hold positions in the companies discussed. And as always, show notes for the episode will be available on the Six Park website, sixpark.com.au, sixpark.com.au. I should also mention a big first for the podcast too, as I'm doing a video recording of this episode, so it'll be up on YouTube if you want to watch it too. So search for the Richards Report in YouTube, or on YouTube, at YouTube, whatever it is, and you can find a video recording of the episode there. With no further ado, my name is Ted Richards, and you're listening to The Richards Report. Here is my discussion with Ray McLean from Leading Teams.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Welcome, Ray. Thanks for coming on The Richards Report.
There's no worries at all, Ted. It's lovely to see you.
Yes, and I wanted to point that out because you're actually the first guest that I'm trialing a bit of the video with, so we're actually seeing each other and not just the audio. So I appreciate you coming on board with this.
No trouble at all.
Okay, Ray, we're going to be speaking a lot about culture this episode, and it's something intangible that it's hard to describe. So I'm interested, how do you describe what culture is?
The simplest definition for us, Teddy, is the behaviour that we accept or we don't within any organisation or team. So for me, culture, you can't not have a culture if you've got a group of people. Somehow they'll evolve into behaving together. And so we would say that, you know, as that happens, some behaviours become accepted within the group, some don't. And what we've tried to do over the journey is to, assist teams to say that we can take some control of that. We can actually have a conversation with one another about what we accept and what we don't. Or if you don't do that, it sort of evolves. We leave it to Mother Nature a bit, and then things annoy us or not, and we don't know what to do with it or not. So I think that's always served me well, that definition, just the behaviour we accept or the behaviour we don't.
Your answer's a lot better than mine. I think about, like, someone's character
is what they do when the eyes aren't on them. And you can kind of get, you put all that together within a team, and that is that accepted behavior when the eyes aren't on you is kind of the culture. That's how I kind of, the other way I kind of think about this, and it's probably a bit more character than culture, is there's a couple of little tests that you can kind of do, and that is what you do with your shopping trolley when you're no longer using it. Some people just throw it away, not my issue. Some people put it back right. And the other interesting kind of litmus test to see how people behave when the eyes aren't on them is also the people's Uber ratings. So you spoke then, Ray, a lot about behaviours. And I guess the old school approach to accepted behaviours was something like the coach would go away, do a bit of thinking on some buzzwords that they want the culture and the team to stand for. They'd get them printed up, put up on a sign, put it on the wall in the office or on the change rooms of the sporting team. Ray, what's your thoughts on this approach to determining accepted behaviours?
Well, I think it's ineffective. So that'd be the first word that comes to mind.
Right, it's a bit of a layup question.
But it doesn't matter whether it's sport or corporate, Ted, because I've seen that as a very similar occurrence in both. If you have the leaders of the organisation go away in a bubble, come back and say, here are our values, and put them on the wall, and values are really the cultural statement, if you like, and no one else has had any chance to reflect on that, be involved in that, well, then you shouldn't expect significant buy-in. So that was one of the things about our work early days, which was quite unique in sport, but is also in corporate in some ways, is to try and get a stake in that from the actual team. So when we're having conversations in sport, for example, or again in any team, we're asking, you know, what sort of behaviours would we want to see from one another? What are we doing currently which is unacceptable or is unproductive? What sort of team do we want to be? So the more that you can have people have a role, have a stake in that somehow, then the better off you're going to be. Otherwise, you do get to the position that you sort of alluded to, and that is, if I've had no stake in that, I see a behaviour which I think is clearly outside our team's behaviour or what's accepted, I then defer to you. I then say, well, when's Ted going to do something about this? Or when are the leaders going to do something about it? Or when is the coach going to do something about it? And so that idea of not feeling as though I've got a sense of control over that, I think is disempowering for teams and individuals. So I think the step that you've talked about is really important. And it does lead to a capacity then for teams to be able to somewhat self-manage. Yep. So they don't have to be supervised by the coach all the time or supervised by their manager all the time. The more that they can, a line that I've used over the journey is that if leaders can create clarity, people can self-manage and get on with their work. And part of that clarity is about behaviour. So, you know, I think there's a real business imperative to doing it because you can improve performance dramatically, but a lot of people don't know or don't want to do that. So it's been an interesting part of our work for a long time.
There's a bit to unpack there, and I want to kind of maybe start off with the start. And when you're determining the accepted behaviours, many teams traditionally choose to ignore a bit of the outside noise and how other teams or other organisations might take into account the perception of them. And they specifically choose, we're going to ignore the outside noise. But you actually take that into account. And can you tell us why you take into account how this team may be perceived by others?
Yeah, I think it gives you a range of perspectives. If you're dealing with a sporting team, for example, that say we don't care what opposition think, here's how we want to be. I like the idea of being able to look at it from a number of different perspectives internally. How we want to be perceived? How do we want to be? What do we want to look like? what's the mood or the culture, if you like, of what we want. But I think it's useful to be able to look from that external perspective, because in the end, particularly in a competitive environment, that's who you're playing or that's who you're up against. If it's in corporate, you know, that idea of how are we perceived in a corporate setting, you'd extend that to, you know, the customer and the client, you know, how do we want to be perceived there? And if we take no notice of that and we're only guided by the bottom line, that's a high risk strategy. And in sport, that would be the equivalent of just looking at the ladder each week and checking how we're going, not really paying attention to the process or the behaviour piece. So I think that's really important. But again, it's just getting those different perspectives so you can get that full picture.
A real life example that I was actually a part of, and Ray, you may have been a part of this too, is when I first came to the club, to the Swans at the end of 2005, after they'd won the premiership in September, this is probably November, December, in a team meeting, Brett Kirk asked me to stand up in front of the team. And he actually kind of grilled me a bit on how Essendon viewed their team. And to be honest, Ray, I wasn't expecting it. I was not prepared for these. And I was a bit kind of taken by it, because the Swans had just come off the premiership and were proven to be the most successful team in the last season. And I was wondering why. I didn't have any context as to why he was asking me. And then I actually found out that conversation with a lot of other draftees in previous years was a bit of a catalyst to work out how they're viewed by others. And I think it might have been Craig Bolton, when Craig came from the Brisbane Lions, maybe 2002, 2003, Craig was actually quite open and honest about the view that from the Lions at the time, if you actually push the Swans and keep pushing them, eventually they will fold. And it was all about addressing that.
Yeah. Well, we see the whole part of this is to have a team identity. And so if you're not frank about, you know, how you are perceived, then that's a problem for a start. And so you'll have some clubs who don't really address the question and they go along as mediocre performers. And we knew, it was interesting, in my first year at the Swans,
Sorry, Ray, what year was that?
I went into 2002, starting in 2003.
Okay. Swans were expected to finish bottom that year, I believe.
Absolutely. I cut out a piece of the Herald Sun. I've still got it in a file over there. I showed it to the group the other day. So it's a tatty old 15 or 16, whatever, 17-year-old piece of paper. And it had the tipsters from Melbourne, and they had... Sydney, eight of them had Sydney finishing bottom, but no one had selected us to be in the final eight. And it doesn't matter about what they do, but it's just gathering that perception. You know, why are we perceived like that? How do we see ourselves? And the players were quite honest. You know, there was a perception that we had, the list had run down. We had five significant players retire. So we were supposed to be in this gloom and doom period. We call it rebuilding or all sorts. You can make up all sorts of excuses for mediocre performance, Ted, both in sport and in corporate. But the idea that we just threw all that into the mix and then said, so how do we want it to be? And that's when you were stepping into a culture which had been established and owned by the players. And so Brett Kirk and others took the responsibility of inducting you in and finding out the perception about them as very seriously, because that's what we could build on. Some players were coming to the club in those latter years, as you know, saying, oh, we just hate playing the Swans. You know, you're in a fight, you're in an arm wrestle from go to woe, you know, and every bit of that used to fuel us. Just the same as, again, being in any team, if you can affirm the really positive parts about how you want to be, if you can align behaviour, it'll improve performance. And we at no stage did we ever sit down at the Swans, I think, and accept that we were the most talented team that ever went round. But I think we would have put up a fair fight if you'd said we weren't the most hard, tough, blue collar, in and out it type of team. So that was our identity.
Yeah.
And then it was a matter of holding people to account, and almost as quickly as you possibly could, questions like that would have served notice to you that, you know, you've come into us. How did you perceive us? And so a part of it's to challenge you a bit, but a part of it's just to check. So
something else which is would be discussed, and not just specific to the Swans, is the line, see something, do something. Can you give a bit of colour as to why that's important, and what that means?
Yeah, sure. I've always held a view that if you can, again, build your organisation around clear values, we used to call it a trademark, but if you can build the organisation around that, then, and you can empower people to take some responsibility for the behaviour on the team, it enables you to spread the base of leadership. So the point we were making before was, if you were in a team, for example, that didn't really own those values or feel like they were yours, you might see something that it doesn't sit well with you, but you go, gee, I hope the coach does something about that soon, or I hope the CEO does. It's a way of disarming yourself. Whereas what we were saying was that it's your team, you created the behaviours. Surely it's fair enough that you could actually have conversations with one another about what's going on. Was that acceptable for us? So having an agreed sort of behavioural framework, if you like, those values, building real strength in the relationships within your team enables you to have the conversation. And that's all I see it as. You said it's, we use the term see something, say something, and that's really what it was.
Yeah.
And it translates into performance. And this is in any organisation. If you see something in your organisation now and you think, gee whiz, I'm not sure about that. Now, it could be the way a client's treated. It could be anything. And you don't have a capacity to challenge that. That behaviour has been given approval. For you, as I know you would have felt from time to time when you're in that defensive unit and someone's not doing what they've got to do, you wouldn't have waited until later to chat about it. You might have been more direct with it. But it's that idea of owning it, seeing it, saying it, and then it what it does do is it keeps us all accountable, so that it sort of rids us of those cumbersome hierarchies that can sometimes limit performance.
Yeah. The most extreme example I've actually ever read about kind of embracing these conversations and what happens if you don't is this study that they did or something they found with Colombian pilots, where they showed examples when there's two pilots flying a plane, and the junior pilot out of the two is flying, the plane is actually safer because the more senior pilot is happy to kind of speak up if he or she notices anything that's wrong.
Correct.
But conversely, if the more senior of the two pilots is flying and the more junior pilot is the backup, they are reticent. They're hesitant to speak up if they notice anything wrong. And it was actually kind of the result of a lot of plane crashes. And
yeah.
It's just providing an ease to have the hard conversation and the culture that embraces that. And I want to cut Ray just for a while, speak about embracing hard conversation. Can you give me an example of a hard conversation you've seen at some time in your experience over the last two decades, and what that one conversation may have done for a team's performance?
I've seen lots and lots of them.
Apologies, I've probably put you on the spot there.
No, that's fine. I think there was a particular group I was involved with once that really stood out to me was we've moved our way into preparing to have some of these conversations about behaviour and about performance, and the most senior of the team was given feedback from the group that he delivered his feedback to them in a really sarcastic way. And so they weren't sure how to take it. And he was a bit stunned, but then he said, oh, yeah, I can understand. And so it led to the conversation, and they were talking to their boss effectively. And I remember coming back a couple of weeks later and saying, and he did something which was really powerful. He said, okay, if I'm doing that, can you help me by stopping me? Just let me know. And they went, yeah, no worries. And it was about 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, I reckon, I was up there and I said, oh, how's Steve going with, you know, the feedback? And they said, oh, it's gone. You know, like he actually manages those conversations better. So whilst it was confronting at the start, a bit for him and a bit for the team, it meant that those conversations around performance that he was having on an ongoing basis from there were much more productive than sort of trying to find a bit of a smart-ass line to deliver his message.
Yep.
And if I had to, a really important one at our group, clearly I'm the oldest and the longest-serving member of our team. And I remember our group at one stage, we always give, you know, feedback for one another along the way, and sometimes we'll formalise it a bit so we make sure that the focus is on me in this case. And the group actually said, and this is going back a while, but they said to me, we need you to trust us more. And I sort of thought, I wonder what that's, you know. And so again, we had the conversation. And I think I'm trusting. But the point they made was really important. They said to me, no, what happens is that if we've got a difficult client, you take it. You take them. And so it stifles our growth. And it was a really important conversation because I was doing it for the right reasons. I was trying to, you know, sort of protect people a bit. But at the end of the day, I was having a massive impact on our performance. And had we not had that conversation, there is no way that our business could be in the shape that it's in today, because I would have continued to be in their way. And the growth we saw after that was just fantastic, but it needed that conversation to actually make it happen. So I just think there's, you know, there's so many, and you can sometimes, when they are a bit tense, it can be, you can sort of feel that. But we've also said, Ted, which I reckon is really important, and it's partly come in our conversation, we can make them more difficult with the language we use. So if we call them hard conversations, if we call them difficult conversations, if we call them harsh conversations, if we call them fierce conversations, it's a bit hard to see someone saying, oh, gee, I can hardly wait for this next fierce conversation.
Yeah.
That's why we use the word genuine.
Yeah.
Genuine is genuine. And yeah. And it could be that it involves a difficulty to it. But if we've built a team where we come from a position of mutual respect for one another, we can start to have those. And you and I, in the end, will know that I'm doing it not for any malicious reason. I actually want you to be better. And I think that was part of what we created at the Swans, for example, was that if you were given firm feedback, I don't think you had to go away and spend long thinking about, oh, do they like me or not? Why would they be saying that? I think you knew that that was delivered because we wanted you to get better and we wanted to get better. And as long as you can do that as a leader, I think you can make significant inroads. But I am really clear with teams. I don't like them using the terms hard, difficult. I always drag them back to genuine. It's just genuine.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a good reframing.
Yeah.
I probably use the word hard or difficult because from memory, it wasn't an easy conversation to start.
No.
And usually, often, the more difficult, the harder, probably the better the opportunity it was to provide the feedback.
Very often, because we put that behaviour to the side.
Yeah.
It was either the person's a bit difficult to, you know, they're a bit prickly, so I won't go there, or, oh, gee, I'm not sure. Yeah. But again, the whole idea is that this becomes a part of your culture, so that when you've had that first time where you know you've just got to deliver that message, that's why we practice those skills, you know. It was no accident that the Sydney players became pretty good at it because we worked at it.
Mm.
And
yeah.
When you see the benefits and when you realise that it's okay, then that becomes a part of your DNA. That becomes a part of your culture. And when new players come into it, they go, oh, wow, is this the way a review works here? Or, oh, And the same in a strong corporate environment, if you see people coming in and you've got a team that's got used to being a bit more robust, it's sometimes a bit confronting for people. But that's, again, that's what I think drives really high performance. If we have either people or behaviour that are no-go areas, we are limiting performance.
I think in the corporate side, I believe Ray Dalio, one of the biggest fund managers in the world, managing hundreds of billions of dollars, he really embraces the feedback and tries to, like you said, reframe it to be a positive. In his book, I think he frames it like someone's providing you a jewel or something like that, just so you appreciate it's like a gift that someone's giving you. And but Ray, you provided an example of something that you've seen in your experience. I thought it's only fair if I provide an example of something that I saw in my time in football, where I saw a genuine conversation have real impact. And before I get into it, I just want to say, I think the best ones were always when it wasn't from the top down, as in like an official captain having the conversation, especially with a young player. It was normally where someone steps up that you weren't expecting. And the example is something that happened on a training camp, and training camps have been on the spotlight recently. This actually happened when I was at Essendon back in 2002, 2003. So I was in probably my second or third year at Essendon, and we did a training camp in Cairn River, which is far east Gippsland in Victoria. And I won't go into this right now, but it was an absolute debacle in so many ways. But what happened was players just were whinging day after day. It really became like a whinge fest. And I'll put myself in that boat. I'm sure I did too. But there was a player that there was one player that halfway through the trip goes, I've had enough of this, and called up a taxi and got a taxi out of there and said, I'm done. And no one spoke about that. It was just like, oh, yeah, he's out of here. And so that wasn't picked up. But I'll never forget, we're sitting around the campfire one night as a whole team. Everyone was just whinging. And it was a third or a fourth year player stood up in front of the whole group. And it's actually David Hill, who's a mate of mine. And he pretty much gave it to the team for the amount of whinging. And this guy was by no means a senior player that would... And it was an incredible moment. It was incredibly powerful. And what ended up happening from that moment, people would always go back to as to, you know, that leadership. And David actually went on to captain the club, partially because they could see that he was happy to stand up when other people and say speak his mind. So that was one example. But there are plenty of guys I played with that had similar abilities to say the right thing at the right time, like Reece Shaw and Nick Smith and others. Ray, moving on from genuine conversations to some things that are in the media right now in the sporting world, and that is two TV shows. Have you seen either of The Test, which is on Amazon Prime, or The Last Dance, which I think is on Netflix? Have you seen either of those?
I've seen The Last Dance one. I've watched that through and seen bits and pieces of The Test.
Okay. All right. Yeah, well, you're actually ahead of me. I've got two episodes to go of The Last Dance. I'm interested in your thoughts on The Last Dance, because I was amazed at the behaviour that was accepted from this incredibly successful team. From things like Dennis Rodman mid-season going on benders, to Jordan smoking cigars whenever, like even... in club uniform, Scottie Pippen not going on the court because he wasn't given the last shot in the game. And to be fair, there was a player that called out that, that was addressed at the time. But these things didn't happen back in the 50s or 60s. You know, this was going on in 1998, my first year. So, Ray, have you Was that a kind of a bit of a surprise to you, some of the accepted behaviours for a successful team there?
Not necessarily, because I think the context is that it's a part of the American culture, American sport, basketball. So I was able to differentiate a little between. I think basketball always lent itself because of the small number on the court that you often had, you know, that hierarchy somewhat. What resonated with me out of it was, I guess, the coach's capacity to manage that. But when the coach goes, or when those players move on, I always think the test of culture is what you leave behind. And so if I look at American, particularly basketball in America, I always look to San Antonio as an example that I prefer to do the study on. I think it's really interesting that a really talented group got together and they were different individuals, and somehow the coach sort of managed all that and you know, they were successful. That's what I guess in my mind I call a bit more the talent model.
Yeah.
And so when I look at things in our sport, there's a few limitations in footy where some would say, oh, we should just go down that path. People should be able to do what they like. It takes 22 people to play the game. And I think that, you know, culturally it's a bit different. When we're talking about, I guess, building that culture, we tend to talk about the players in two terms. One of them is, and it's about trust. One of them is about trusting their competence. So have they got the skills and can they apply their skills under pressure, which there was no doubt about a good handful of those players. And then on the other side is, you know, can they yield to the team when they need to, like the character side. And really the significant part in that documentary was that in the end, Michael Jordan did. He yielded to team somewhat because he'd had that long successful period as an individual but craved some sort of team success. And so there was movement that way. Now it was they were still pretty. They were still a pretty different bunch. But I think that's the challenge: is that if you're only focused around talent, then you can collect that up, and sometimes it works. But again, if you're looking for the long-term sustainability in an organisation. That's why I like the San Antonio example, because that's a long-term successful story. Not the intense period of premierships or titles, but always punching above their weight in terms of money. So that's what we are to. I always say to people too that there's more than one way to sort of skin a cat. So. I'm not knocking those, but in our world, we would pay a little bit more attention to can that star player come into team when he needs to. And I think they showed enough of that. That's why they were able to do it. But I think that's why I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah.
But I think we're probably particularly in the AFL system, I think we have... I think you could have a Michael Jordan type player in your team, and that won't guarantee you success because it's such a big team.
Yeah, it's 1/18th.
Yeah, that's right.
What's that, 6% or something like that, as opposed to 20% of your team where it's 1/4.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the difference. So I think there's great lessons in both. I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I tend to take into consideration those sorts of things when I look at that. And I think it's a really interesting position in the NBA now, because you have the other added layer, which is of course private ownership, and then the extent to which the franchise player, the best player, runs the franchise. And our code is again completely different, because we don't have private ownership, and so I just like looking at all of those sports for that reason, but just the same as what I like looking at the structure of how businesses are too, and whether or not they're structured to get the best out of themselves or not.
Yeah. It's interesting what you said there about San Antonio and kind of having that long-term success, maybe passing the baton to the next generation. I'm aware of the Swans. The line I like is that people before me that, you know, planted a seed to grow a tree under the shade of which they never sat. You know, there are some people that put some things in place to build something, to have that long sustained success. Now, the other show that I want to speak about is The Test. And I'm aware that you haven't actually seen this yet, but in my notes here, Justin Langer, who I'm actually a big fan of, I've read some of his books that are fantastic. It's great to see and get the insight early days, how much Langer focused on the accepted behaviour and the process, which we've spoken to. So I don't want to speak on that, but there was one conversation which some very honest feedback was given. And that was when Khawaja on camera provided some pretty honest feedback to Langer. And I thought that was an incredible conversation by Khawaja, because personally, I always found it hard to provide the coaches honest, frank feedback, because they determine my contract. And I'm aware of that. So, but Khawaja actually on camera, gave Langer some feedback, and Langer took it on board. You could see it was a great thing for the team.
Again, if you're in a leadership role, whether it's sport or corporate, and you can't accept feedback, you've taken away a huge amount of the potential for your growth. You said before, what's feedback like? And I like it. I like your example, but the way that I've always talked about it is it's like being offered a plate of food. You should be thankful you got it, but you don't have to eat the lot. You know, that idea of, and if you're close to that, I'm not sure how or why you would expect that your followers would be open to it. So I think I had a couple of years with the Australian cricket team years ago, but I think that Justin is like that. But he came in at a pretty critical period.
Yep.
The team had come off some horrible crises. There was, the brand, the whole culture, if you like, was under question. So I think someone like him who comes in with a focus that's around behaviour and values first, and then the rest will come along, to me was just an obvious pick. And he'd come off a track record of having impacted Western Australian cricket pretty positively in that time, because they were in a fair bit of trouble when he took over there. So I think that's the thing. Early days as a leader, you have to be a bit more directed. You have to come in with a pretty clear plan, but you also have to create that environment. We say none of us are as smart as all of us. So if you've got someone sitting in your group who knows something that's going to help us and that can't get to the table, then you deserve to be mediocre. So I think that's why he would be doing that. He would feel free to give... I've met Justin a few times and he would not be backward in giving his honest opinion to me about what he thought. But I think...
That comes across in the documentary.
Yeah, and I think that... But I think that would be reciprocated. Yep. I think he wouldn't care if he had to get into one of those strong conversations. But as long as you're both coming from the right place, that we want you to be better and we want our team to be better, I can't see any problem with that. Mm. I think sometimes people fear conflict a bit because they don't commit to resolution. They want us to, if you and I are having a slightly more heated exchange now about something, I would like that, but it might mean we have to discuss it a bit more. It might mean we have to call quits halfway through and go, why don't we just go away and think about this and then we'll get back. But if you and I have a strength in our relationship and a commitment to resolution, there's no problem with that. What I find in weak teams, corporate or sport, is that they, when they can't have those conversations, they actually engage in what we call artificial harmony. They pretend everything's okay. They sweep the harder conversations under the carpet and they move around.
We'll get to corporate shortly because I'm.
Does that make sense?
It does, and I'm very keen to explore how corporate may, the similarities and how they may differ from sporting teams.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to just finish out the talk on sport just for with another question here on. At the time of recording, it's mid-May. Footy, AFL, and NRL is back in a few weeks, and financially. Clubs are hurting, and the need for immediate success has never been more important. To use a term that we're hearing every day, unprecedented times. Ray, in your opinion, like what could be a warning sign that a team, their culture probably hasn't handled the last 3 months that well?
Well, the thing that I there's a few things in that. You know, someone said to me, unprecedented times, and I said, oh, when I first started in the industry at St Kilda in 1994, we had 5 full-time staff, and that's the reason why we tapped into the players, because that was the whole origin of this model, was that we knew that as an organisation, we were never going to be as well-resourced as others, so we had to get smarter with less. So that's the first thing. So we'll get by. If you don't think that your players are capable of helping you to do that, well, then you will fail. But clubs who believe that they've got a capacity within their playing group to really foster leadership and have players step up and take more responsibility, they'll do that. They'll be okay. They'll work their way through it. The other part is that if they see that the need for success is somehow heightened now, then they've probably made a mistake as well. The strength of your culture will get you through this year to next year to the year after to the year after. The point I made to the Sydney Swans players when I spoke to them I've actually continued working with them. So we've been running sessions all the way through, knowing that in isolation, you can still be a better player. You can still actually work. You can still actually think. You know, so we've been really driving the players a bit to get them to, you know, to that proposition. But I think that there's so much about how you set your club up and its culture leading into this that you're almost just going to be, you'll get what you deserve out of it.
Yep.
So if you haven't placed a value on players as leaders, if you haven't placed a value on relationships, if you walk back in and you pretend like nothing's happened, so let's just get back into it, it's a bit the same in corporate. You know, if you have people who have people returning to work, and as leaders, you don't acknowledge and you don't actually review and you don't go, what happened there? What did you learn in that period of isolation? If you don't regather, that's the whole idea of a culture. It's almost, you know, in a military sense, it's almost regathering under the flag. It's, we've had this battle, let's learn from it, what happened there, and let's get ready for the next. So I think that's, there's a lot in it, but I just love the idea of having that focus, as I said, when working with the Swans players, of how can we get better when we get back? How can the leaders, we've been working with the leaders so that, you know, they're clued in. They've been thinking about, say, if you've got to run drills in isolation, you've got 8 over there, 8 over there, 8 over there, 8 over there. I'd go back to the old days and say, well, why wouldn't a senior player or a trusted leader be running each of those?
Yeah.
So you'd never want this to happen again, ever. But out of it, you'll see some things that will surprise. And the other point that you made is how do you sort of know? Well, again, the parallel between sport and corporate's pretty straightforward here. When people were sent off really suddenly to work in a less supervised sense, the ones who are well self-managed will survive and thrive, and the ones who are average performers who needed supervision will be the ones who struggle.
Yeah.
Simple as that. You know, we were discussing this the other day with the Swans, like, who are the ones you would just trust? But they're coming back in good shape. You don't have to worry about it. Well, they're the self-managed players who do that just as a part of their DNA. And the more of them you've got, the better. So that's how we've sort of seen that.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting season for so many reasons. There will be the teams that fail at the last 3 months, probably provide excuses, wave the white flag and start very quickly talking about next year. And I think they'll use excuses because there are excuses could be there, you know, unprecedented times, et cetera, by that.
Yeah.
But there are going to be teams that really surprise people. Really.
Oh, I think it'll be fascinating. I think, as you said, the excuses won't be really stark and easy to see. It'll be through language first.
Yeah.
So when I've heard people from opposition clubs say, is there going to be an asterisk next to the premiership this year? Will it count?
The teams who really care don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Like they are saying it's another premiership. Like at the end of the day, I did say to the Swans players the other day, if you happen to win it, I reckon you'll still celebrate like you earned it. If someone's already allowing some of that conversation to happen, then that's when they are almost sowing the seeds for, you know, making it just a bit more difficult. So I think there's a lot in that. We've been really focused, Stephen Covey's worked a lot of stuff around the things that will concern us, but what can we actually influence and control? And having that conversation with some of the young Swans players the other day, I just said to them, no, it's difficult. You know, you're at home. I had one young fella's on his parents' farm up in, you know, South Australia and all that. And I said, but what do we know, though? And they said, oh, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, what do you know? What do you know will happen? And one of them said, oh, well, we will play again. I said, hallelujah. Yeah, we will. Will it still be on an oval shape? Yeah. Will there still be four posts at the end, two shorter ones and two long? You know, I haven't heard they're changing that much. In fact, I haven't heard that they're using a round ball instead of an oval ball. You know, we went through, it was a silly conversation, but it was just to remind them that, you know, train, we've conditioned the players really well to play Saturday, 6 day recovery, play again, do. We've been using the analogy a little bit about the military, because part of it's my background, but is that when you're preparing there, you're preparing on a daily basis for an event you don't know will come. And that's what's happening now. I said, the better prepared you are, and when the league says, you're now being called, it's the 11th of June or whatever, if you're really confident that your preparation and you've been able to keep your mind active and ready, then you'll just go, right, oh, I'm ready. But if you've made those, if you've had those thoughts of, oh, gee whiz, you know, we only got 3 weeks to prepare, perhaps I'll get injured, well, you sort of know what's going to happen.
And now a word from our sponsor. In this episode, I've been speaking about the benefits professional help can do to help a team be their best and lift their performance. I was lucky enough to have Ray for a period of time when I was at the Swans, and I was lucky enough to have a team of coaches all around me. Of course, you could always try and do these things by yourself, but it helps to have an expert on your side. Having someone there to help you when the pressure is on, or when you've hit a few speed humps along the way, it can help you get through these difficult times. Coaches and experts can get your strategy right, help maintain your focus on the right things, tweak the plan if necessary, and keep you focused on achieving that end goal. And investment management is no different. In the past, getting advice about a diversified investment portfolio according to your risk profile was something that only the wealthy could afford. Technology is now making this much more accessible to people. You don't need to have the large sums of money once required in the past. If you'd like to find out how SixPark can set you up and manage your own globally diversified investment portfolio, then go to sixpark.com.au, sixpark.com.au. Back to my conversation with Ray.
Ray, we've spoken a lot about the Swans in this, but I know you've worked with a lot of other AFL teams and a lot of teams in other sports over two decades now. Mm. No doubt you would have seen some average teams become great teams, but I'm also interested to explore the opposite. How a good team's culture can fracture. So can you give me a bit of an idea about how quick that can happen?
Sure. Probably the most important factor is if you have alignment between your what I call your key centers of influence, then that almost guarantees that you'll continue to operate within that higher level of performance. You know, we use the term punch with the heavyweights.
Yep.
If you have a change to that structure, let's say in sport you have a change in coach, you know, there's been a few sackings, there's been some sort of, you know, turmoil, and they're not aligned, that would be the first thing. Almost in every team where you've seen them go from perhaps that higher performing to bottoming out somehow, there's been some sort of dysfunction amongst the key people. As a result of that, you've probably then started to see behaviour which never used to be tolerated, but it is now. And then people start to wonder, well, hang on a minute, how does that happen? If you look back, a really interesting, there's some, you know, books and that have been written about it, but the Hawthorn Footy Club going from the 80s where they were a powerhouse, you just couldn't get near them, to later into the 90s where they were on the verge of extinction. And if you looked at some of the things, they were known as the family club, cooking the barbecues on the terraces on a Thursday night at training. All of that went out. All of a sudden, you know, there was this hierarchy where, you know, they were becoming more the silver tails, and they had this loss of identity, if you like. Now, what happened, of course, under Al Clarkson was that he regathered everyone and they realigned. And you know, away they go again. But certainly their decline was some pretty significant changes in personnel, some changes in behaviour which were against, you know, what we knew we stood for. And to me, you know, I've said this a lot in sport, complacency creeps in, it doesn't announce itself. So you sort of, it's just those small things you let go. Remember we said before, it's that standard you walk past, all of a sudden that becomes acceptable. And then another one, and then another one, and then you go, how the hell did we end up here? It's yeah. Not like you just wake up one morning and go, gee, we've gone from really high performing to, you know, a poorer club. It's there are things that were allowed to happen along the way. So I'd say they're the two ways for me, is dysfunction in the key centres of influence and then acceptance of behaviour outside, which we felt was fair and reasonable for our culture.
That's quite fascinating there. Ray, let's now pivot from sport to corporate, which we spoke about before. We've already kind of touched on the obvious similarities between the two. How do they differ from each other? Do they differ from each other?
Look, I have a strong belief that the difference is not great. Like I'll have, for example, I was working with a group of lawyers in Sydney some time ago, and there were a number of, they're all partners in the firm, and there was quite a number of them. And I sort of talked about culture and, you know, was giving some examples. And I said that, you know, in the AFL environment of equalisation, what Hawthorn and Sydney and Geelong have done is staggering, because it means that they've actually appreciated that culture can give you a competitive edge. And one of the lawyers said to me, oh, yeah, but really, you know, like, is that going to work for lawyers? And I said, well, not for you, but for some others that could, you know, like it was, I don't care whether you're lawyers or I don't care whether you're, I think what happens for me, the observation I'd make, Ted, is that every group has their excuses for doing what they do. So I don't reckon I've had a corporate client yet where the lawyers go, oh, you know, but we're lawyers, we, you know, we're a bit whatever, or had a big advertising company that I worked with said, oh, you know, we're in advertising, we're a bit, you know, and oh, we're, you know, we're in schools and we do. And I think that's what happens, is that we can sometimes say that becomes us, but it doesn't. You know, you can actually choose the culture you want.
I think that's why that I see the similarities. The other part which happened that day was that one of the lawyers said to me, "Oh, yeah, but that's a bit easier in sport because you sort of know what your premiership is." And I said, "Well, if you're the leader of this business and you haven't made it clear to me
what your goal
premiership is, yeah. You've failed me. Yeah. You know, like you have failed me. It won't be on the one day in September. It will be a range of measures, but it will still... I think the big difference is that in sport, we give more regular feedback all the time and we check against that to know where we're going. I think sometimes in corporate, we don't stop as much to celebrate what we have done and we certainly don't give feedback in that open way as regularly as what we should. They'd be the differences for me.
Yeah, that's quite fascinating for a publicly listed company. They may only have one AGM a year and provide two shareholder updates or something like that. So they may only be held accountable twice a year, whereas in the sporting world, it's almost like there's an AGM every weekend.
You can remember, I'm sure that as a player, if we'd left you for a week without feedback from someone, you would have been worried about what the hell's going on here.
I can remember someone telling me it's when you stop talking to you should be worried.
Yeah, and I think that regular update, those sorts of things are really important. And let's face it, I think the other part that we sometimes don't recognise is that if you look back over the past few years and there's been some royal commissions in certain areas,
yep,
they happen for the reasons we're talking about.
Yeah.
It happened through a failure of leadership and an inability at a cultural level to challenge behaviour, which is unacceptable. And then it becomes a part of your norm to the point where finally someone does something, then it breaks open and you realise, oh, this is a bit bigger than what we thought, and then all sorts of things happen. But make no mistake about it, they are the, you know, that's the way it goes. It wasn't overnight. It was that acceptance of. It was a focus on what are we really rewarding. If you only reward winning, it's the same happens in sport. It used to happen, I don't think it happens as much, but is that if you are winning and you turn a blind eye to off-field behaviour, in the end it'll get you.
And
I think that's the same in corporate. If your bottom line is really healthy and your share price is great and all of those sorts of things happen, but you know that somewhere underneath there, that's the only measure we're looking at, then sometimes you get caught out. And I think that's been some of the examples. I didn't hear anyone say otherwise, say with the Banking Royal Commission, for example, that it wasn't other than, you know, a failure of leadership. And that's not pointing the finger at one person, but it's that idea of if you're in a leadership role, you have to accept responsibility for the culture, and culture is the behaviour we accept or don't.
Yeah.
So we sort of find ourselves back almost at where we began.
Ray, I'm conscious of time because I did hold you up with the...
It's no problem.
But I've got quite a few questions that I just want... A couple of quick questions that I want to finish up on. One of which is, we at the start of our conversation, I mentioned see something, do something. Mm-hmm. And from a corporate lens and people now working predominantly, working remotely...
Yep.
What do you think that may do? Because you're probably going to be seeing less behaviour, both good and bad, where you can address the little things that may incrementally, creep in.
Yeah, I think you're still going to have behaviour. So even if you and I work together and we're going to work remotely for the rest of our lives, like, I don't think that will happen necessarily, but, you know, we'll still behave. So from a corporate perspective, what I'm hearing now from clients I've been in touch with the way through, is that it has sharpened the focus on who can work, who is well self-managed and can work without supervision, and some who have struggled. So if you don't have that conversation out loud and you just heard everyone back in, you've missed a great opportunity. The other part is that if someone has shown that ability, why wouldn't we reward that and allow them more flexibility in how they work? If you've shown that you can perform at a really high level and you've been working remotely and that suits you somewhat, they're all the things which I think are going to be great opportunities out of this, but they won't be if we just bring people back in and sort of go, righto, let's get back to it. So yeah. I think there's some real opportunities in there, but again, they'll go back to the fact, Ted, that if you don't have the conversation, it's still the same, no different than if we were in the workplace together and you are not performing as well as you could and I'm going really well and we don't have that conversation, it's still the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think that part hasn't changed. But I think it will enable us to pose more of those questions. And we may, you know, let's be frank, with the virus the way it is, we might be forced into that sort of more flexible, open workplace anyway. But I would have said rather than it being seen as a terrible thing, there's an opportunity in there. I still think that you can get people who are in their logical teams together to talk about performance and to talk about behaviour. So if you're at home and you're not delivering what you need to do for me to enable me to be able to, you know, we still need to have those conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think it's all or none, so that's important.
I think I can remember in Agassi's book, it might have been him or his trainer, use the analogy of thermostats and thermometers. There are those people that just, they're not a thermometer. They don't need other people to kind of set how they're going to act. They do it. And there was others that they need other people to determine how they're going to act and behave. And I quite liked that analogy.
Oh, I think that goes back to what we said before. If you have those really, if you've got a clear sense of purpose, if you've got really strong self-management skills, you'll find a way.
Mm.
You'll actually find a way.
Ray, I received an email from Leading Teams the other day. It was a fascinating email about culture, behaviour and the impact in terms of the COVID-19 right now. There was a line in the email that I quite liked. There is no softer pillow than a clear conscience.
Yep.
Ray, what was that in regard to and why did you include that?
We, when this first broke, we met on the Sunday night as leaders of the business and made a commitment that as much as possible, we would keep everyone on the team.
Yep.
We worked through some of those scenarios, but knowing that we don't know all the answers yet. But what I meant there was that by Monday, we could go to our people with some information, some reassurance. And the idea of no softer pillow than a clear conscience is that what you're telling them, you can rest comfortably with. Are you being open? Are you being genuine? Like if I'd gone and said, oh, look, don't panic, folks, this will all blow over and then got rid of half the workforce. It's an idea of, I guess it's an idea first and foremost that as a leader, or as any, really anyone, but as a leader, can you live comfortably with yourself?
Yeah, well, I guess a lot of the conversations, not conversations that leaders would enjoy having in terms of...
Not at all.
I think you call them genuine, but there's no doubt they'd be hard in terms of when... revenues and business security is been significantly
absolutely
impacted. Yeah, and
I think that's why we sort of made the decision that if we say to people we don't have all the answers, but we'll keep you informed. To the our I guess our commitment to you is that you know when we know things we'll share things with you. And that was about as much as we could do. And again, that meant that every, you know, Sunday night we gathered as a group of leaders via Zoom and we said, okay, you know, how's it all going, checking in on. Because there was a sort of a wave of things that had to happen. First and foremost, you had to accept that people were worried about them first. So you did need to go back and say, look, find out what's happening with your mortgage. Find out what's happening with your partner's job. Find out what's happening with homeschool. Get yourself settled. Don't worry about the work yet. You know, we can talk to clients, we can get there, but unless you're settled first, you're not going to be very productive anyway. Mm. And that we sort of got through that in a few days and people were then working out where they were positioned and then you could have more meaningful conversation. I think the important thing, though, is that sometimes people feel like I'm not going to communicate with them until I know, until I have the answer. And that can be a long time coming.
Yep.
So I think that just that slightly more regular contact, being as frank as you can, letting them know that our endeavour as a high priority was not to lose people. And so, you know, just working our way through until we...
Well, Ray, it's an incredible time, be it sporting or corporate, what we're going through right now. So I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to have this conversation. Ray, if someone wanted to find out more about Leading Teams, I assume the Leading Teams website.
Yep.
Where can they find you on social media?
Well, I think the website's the best spot.
Ray, something I didn't get to was your book. I actually read your book over 10 years ago.
There's two.
I think, which one, what are the names of the two?
Any Given Team and Teamwork.
I've read Any Given Team and I looked for it and I'm embarrassed to say, I now live in Melbourne. It may not have made the trip down from Sydney to Melbourne.
That's very annoying because I'm sure I would have given you that copy. Who knows?
I purchased that. And what I was annoyed because there was a lot of highlighting throughout notes, which would have been quite beneficial for this discussion.
I think the point of writing that book, Ted, is that that's the reason why we grew Leading Teams. We wanted to be a team ourselves that was held to account against the model that we espouse. So we're pretty comfortable with that idea and we never wanted to be pigeonholed into one area. So the title of the book was really important, even though it seems like it was just a nice title, Any Given Team. But it was really designed so that if we look across, you know, we've got 80% corporate now and 20% sport. If we look across those, it's such a wide and varied mix of businesses and teams. And that's precisely what we wanted. We believe our model stacks up in any team. So that was important to us.
Yeah. Well, Ray, just to wrap it up, I want to thank you for the coaching and development you provided me over the years at the Swans. You pushed me to have the genuine conversations. And to be honest, I felt like shit sometimes, you know, in the moment, having those discussions, especially if they were a close mate.
Yeah.
But when I look back at them now, I can more often, like, I can actually see the benefit that it provided the team, and I'm grateful. You know, it's a real life skill.
Yeah, and that's what I think. The other day we had a conversation. I had 10 coaches who've joined a forum. I just said, while you've been stood down, I'm happy to keep working with you and, you know, do some coach development. But part of the conversation came up about a lot of the guys like yourself and the Swans ones I named, but Leo, Barry and those of you who have gone on and been successful in business. Now, that's because you educated yourself, but at the end of the day, you've also transferred your skills over. So I love the fact that I run into a lot of players now who I've worked with over the journey, and it's not purely their academic preparation, if you like, and transition into the workplace. It's that they actually took those skills with them. Yeah. And so they're not offended by feedback. They want to get better. They are self-managed, you know. So sometimes subtly you forget the really good skills you had that made you a terrific player do transition. So I think that's fantastic.
Ray, I appreciate the compliments here. I wasn't searching for compliments, but I might finish it up there. Ray, thank you very much for having a chat on the Richards Report.
No worries at all.